Session number 106-99.
Brigadier Rymer Jones, Reel 12. You were telling me about the rule that the British had to pay for everything when they were in
Yes.
Cologne.
Well, there are two interesting things followed, and that was that the guards, those were people we were interested in, because they were there, of course, the men were getting very upset because they had to pay on the very good tramways and railways and so on. Whereas the Germans, of course, when they'd been down in Belgium, occupied France, they, of course, didn't pay anything at all, quite the opposite. So they got almost a striking effect. And Plumer, who was the big boss in those parts, he sent a message home which said the guards are threatening to burn the transport as they're being made to pay. I am entirely in their favour and am proposing to make everything free. And so we did. We had the dress circle for the officers, could go wherever they liked at the opera in Cologne. The men could, when they had leave, could go wherever they were. And I even went right down to the Swiss border, having a look at the old Nibelung and all the rest of the old stories. I was never very impressed with the Rhine, you know. The castles didn't beetle at me enough, and I didn't like it at all. But there we were, our chaps were very cozy, until the famous khaki election took place at home. Now, Lloyd George, of course, was the kingpin, and he arranged that everybody who was home in England at the time, for the military, could then vote and go home. No more Germany. Well, so it happened that after the war, of course, the people had been out there longest, they got home leave. And then gradually, until you got the conscripts, even those who only had 5 minutes war were at home, and they were allowed to. Well, that didn't go down, was it? Well, and men were saying, like the French had at Verdun, we're not having this. They're striking. And that was striking. Merely the men refused to come on parade one morning.
Is this in your battery or in the brigade as a whole, the 174 Brigade?
In the army as a whole. Army in Cologne. At any rate, I don't know what happened in the others. It's probably equally bad. And they had to take action straight away to make things easier, but they couldn't put that back. Where the fellow who'd sweated it out the whole war was kept in there, because, you know, it was all carefully arranged beforehand that this class of people could go home and join civil street again according to their service and what they'd done. And this, of course, ruined it, old Lloyd George with his... because he was going crackers at the time. He nearly had another war, you know, with Mustafa Kemal, which was only saved by General Harrington out there through peaceful means with the Turks. But we still did stupid things.
What did you do when your battery refused to turn out?
They're the only one that didn't.
Was there
In fact, because the magnificent NCOs said that anybody that did these silly things would be ducked in their horse troughs. At any rate, the men were marvellous, really. They were in that battery. How they stuck it, I don't know, because they were always made to paint and polish in addition to fighting the war, and they were very proud of themselves.
Which battery were you in at this time? Was it the same one, of A, B, C and D? Do you remember?
The officers had gone off, and I was left as adjutant. I was adjutant, and when the general came around and said, I want to see your arrangements for demobilisation, you see. So I said to the clerk, come on, show. He said, no, well, that's not good enough. He said, what are you actually doing? I said, I'm sending the fellows with the longest service home. He said, but that's very naughty. I said, I can't help it, sir. I'm saying what's fair, not what's naughty. And I just sent them home, and their longest serving ones came first, which was fair after all, wasn't it?
And did that calm
Because, you
down?
See, people were looking for work in England. This was the terrible time that was finishing, when half the workforce of England, men and women, were working the streets and doing silly things in order to get a copper. This went on for ages. It was a terrible time, I can't tell you. And to have these, a lot of them sneaky little men who were doing that in the war for 5 minutes, coming home and pinching the jobs, it was beyond everything, you see. No, I tell you, it didn't last long.
Did your unofficial actions, this first, you know, the length of service, deciding who went home first, did that reduce the sort of tension and trouble in the batteries fairly quickly, once they knew you were doing that?
Well, I think so. I think so.
There was no more trouble after this refusal to parade?
No, there was no more trouble, because that hastened the day when everybody went home on leave, and we got the drafts out, you see, because we were Army of the Rhine then. It was no longer war. We were Army of the Rhine, and until July of that year, don't forget, it was only an armistice. The war wasn't ended till July, not November, the next July. And in order to safeguard things, we marched over Hohenzollern Bridge to go into the open country there until peace had been signed, is there? And I always remember it because my groom had come out. I had a string of five horses then. And the groom came out and said, shall I saddle the paddy horse, or will it be the Jago beast? He was Irish. That's another story, too. But I said, all right, I'll have paddy, which had been bequeathed to me by somebody going home. And not as my property, but to use as charger, you see. And Paddy was a beautiful horse. I won a point of price on him, actually. But he had a very bad habit of kicking at lampposts. He didn't like them. And I hadn't really appreciated it at the time. I said, oh, I'll have the paddy horse. And so the paddy horse was saddled up for me, and off we went in this long string of the Army of the Rhine over Hohenzollern Bridge with Plumer, who was the boss out there, who'd done this business of the trams and so on. They're taking the salute. Incidentally, he was one of the High Commissioners in Palestine later on, where he didn't like it at all. A magnificent fellow, the only chap in high command in the Boer War who didn't fail in this war. A great chap. And when we got to the saluting point, of course there was a lamppost there. And oh, petty horse kicked out against my next door to me. It was the CO of the brigade, you see, and kicked his horse well in the ribs, and we both went squattering across almost into Provo. I don't know how I got away with that. But there we remained in the open country until July the 1st, you see.
You mentioned point to point. Was there much hunting, point to point racing, that sort of thing going on?
Oh, no.
At that time?
That developed at that time. I left there and it was really getting. I was a member of the Cologne business, but that was our very early days. And when I say point to point, it was a very mild thing behind the lines compared to what came later. At any rate, there were little bits of friction out in our villages, and it was chiefly due to the fact that some of the troops felt we're the winners and we can pinch people's pigs and so on, you know, and put them in the pot. Well, that was very naughty, of course. It's not our way of doing it at all, normally. And so the burgomaster was sending Fräulein Bauer along to say, how can we work this out, and so on, you see. And we were sitting at the table on this particular day. It was very naughty of me, I suppose, but I said, Fräulein, do you know why we make your men on the trams and buses, etc., in Cologne, get up and give up their seats? And she said, well, I suppose it was because that's what our officers did down in Belgium and France. I said, no, not at all. We make them give up their seats for their wives. I said, no, unless, Fräulein Bauer, you're going to train your men better, because the military were everything at the beginning of the 1914 war. They used to push civilians off the pavement, these stuck-up officers, push them off the pavements and so on. They were a terrible lot. So I said, unless you train your men, it won't be many years before we have another war. I often wonder what she thought when they did get the other war, because they were behaving much the same.
Was there any sign of political unrest in Germany? Because it was going through a very difficult time, not particularly in the Cologne area.
Well, it was a fight for existence. You see, the finance collapsed entirely. It was terrific. I was out doing a little job out in, it wasn't Vienna, it was Budapest, when the thing had collapsed entirely. And what you gave was not money. If you went and get your hair cut, they said, don't give them money, give them a cigarette. And a packet of cigarettes would keep the farmers it got down to. They were the only people who could afford them. And it was a terrible hardship. Now, in this case, and I gave a dinner party.
That was later in the 20s, though, wasn't it? The collapse of the financial system.
Yes, well, I mean, it started off as early as that. Yes, I agree. Yes, it was. And because my dinner party for eight cost me 1 and 6 pence in English terms. And I gave the waiter tuppence, or by correspondent, and he fell on his knees and wanted to kiss my hand. It was most embarrassing. And we can be very hard when it comes to that. In July, I think it was, of 1919, I was sent on what they called a battery commander's course, which was both shooting on Salisbury Plain and also the technical stuff in Shubri Nurse, which even they filled your time, you know, they even made you do your driving drill. You taking the officers. I had two very nice officers who used to work with me, and we took it in turn to do lead, centre and wheel. And we go bounding about because they use the old 12-pounders, which only the horse artillery used. Rotten old guns, but we used to leap ditches with the guns bumping over behind. And it was all very good fun indeed. But after the shooting was over and the course finished, they said to me at the War Office, you don't want to go back. And I, as I was getting myself engaged, and without any money at all, chucked up my adjutant's job, which I got extra pay for, and didn't go back. My groom gave away all the gear that I'd collected, and I was a silly young ass. But I didn't want to go back, and I was always buoyed by the thought that Charles Vickery had got me accepted for service in the Sudan, which always led to commanding an area of the Sudan and helping you in the future. So I didn't go back, but was posted then, first of all, to Swanage, which was a wartime place, which didn't really matter much, and then to Bulford on Salisbury Plain. Now, it was a very bad time. I was silly to give up the adjutant's job because the men were doing nothing, really, except as recruits. The sergeants were taking them in the ordinary gun drill and so on. And we had our horses still, except although we had our horses, we had the first mechanized two divisions, which were rather scornfully looked at. And we were allowed to keep our charges to do some hunting on good terms.
How did you feel about mechanization? Because you'd been a progressive young officer in the First World War. Did you appreciate that mechanization was a good thing then or not? Or how did you feel about it?
Well, I did, but generally feeling there was awful fighting against it. Because we still fought right through till the next war. The hunt and shoot and fishing idea. And it was made easy for subalterns. In fact, an officer after I'd left that Bulford went there and said that every officer should be made to join a good hunt and to do some fishing. And everybody said, because we'd been scrubbing our britches and doing it on nothing, you know. And we were allowed to use our troop horses. What do they call them, 15 bobbers. And it was all very jolly, but when this fellow came doing things like that, I'd left, fortunately. They said, well, we're not so keen on hunting. And I took a thing against it. I said, all right, I'm all for hunting. It's not going to cost a lot of money. You're not going to drive, you're not going to dress yourself in ridiculous clothing. And if you had a couple of hounds against one fox instead of about 20 hounds, and I should be more in favour of it. And I've never been in favour of it since, frankly. And so suddenly out of the blue, because while the men were being trained in these simple things, I was turned in with the other officers to groom about 7 horses a morning. And then in the afternoon you were free, and we started simple polo. And Otherwise, and if it was wet, the whole rest of the day and evening you played bridge.
Did you ever consider leaving the army? You were a regular, but did you ever, at this time, did you consider leaving? Take up another career?
No. No. I was too devoted to the gunners as a start. I had an opportunity when I was out in Cairo later, owing to the fact that they'd allowed temporary officers, if they were good enough, to become regulars. It meant that you had an enormous number of officers. And the rule was there, you had to do 13 years as a subaltern in the gunners before they'd consider you being promoted.
Had you kept your rank of major, or was that war just for the war?
Oh, that was right at the end of the war.
Did you?
I was a captain as all temporary, you see, as an adjutant. And after that, nix. I came down to subaltern. I didn't mind that so much, you know, because the gunners were a marvellous crowd of subalterns, but you know, in those days, a major, insisted on his rights, that you sort of got up if you passed him in mess. If he passed you, he got out of your chair, and it was all quite ridiculous. And the same thing happened in infantry and everywhere else. And that was regardless of the fact that you'd been more senior in the war and so on. It took me till 1929 to make captain. 1929. Now, of course, I was in great trouble because, like an ass, I got engaged, and that meant to say the Sudan wouldn't have anything to do with it. And that's when my Colonel Vickery wrote to me and started, "You bloody young idiot." And that's the last I ever spoke to him. It was a great privilege what he'd done for me. And at any rate, I was...
Had you realised the consequences of your engagement at the time, or did it come to a surprise as you?
No, I knew what was happening, but in those days, the aftermath of the war, everybody was crazy, the bright young things and so on, everybody made a damn nuisance to themselves. And it was a very rotten time all together. And I knew that I'd done it. You know, I had met my wife when I went on convalescence for a fortnight, the end of Passchendaele, to South France, where she was helping in the French canteens. And I was determined to marry her, which I did. And I'm very glad I did. It was a marvellous time we had in Egypt on nothing. And she was very popular, and people liked us. But I hadn't fully appreciated it at the time. Of course, I wouldn't have done it. I killed her. Because the prenatal business, I could only go to quite good people, but I could have gone to much better, because it was very complicated with her. Only I happened to be on the sea when it finally happened. But as you say, we were all daft in those days, and you didn't really work out what the consequences. Live for the day. In the middle of that spell at Bulford, I had noticed that I'd been selected with other people to go to the infantry during their first great troubles in Ireland. And I'm very glad I did it. I think, on the whole, I preferred the infantry life. So I found myself bounding over to Dublin, where there were 9 battalions of infantry alone, and we had a magnificent CO who was changing everything. He'd been in the Sudan, a first-class chap.
What was his name, do you remember?
I would have remembered, only you put it out of my head.
It'll come back to you. Which battalion were you sent to? Was this the 1st Battalion, the King's Own Regiment?
Yeah.
And do you know when you were posted there? Was it 1920 or 21?
Oh, it was 20. This was during this awful time where everybody played bridge. And there was nothing happening, really. You see, you'd only just got... All your fellows had been demobbed. And these were the new lot coming in, so there was no combined training you could do.
What was the month, do you remember? Or what part time of the year you went to Ireland in 1920?
I went there in July, I think. 1920. And there one was immediately in full cry in every way. Things were easy enough. For example, when the transport officer went on leave, the CO said, "Oh, you do it, Raymond." And I used to take horses out one after another and go to remarkable facilities in the parks, the 40-acre field where you would gallop yourself silly. And the CO sometimes came out with me. That was during that period and afterwards. And then, of course, things began to get dirty.
What were, before we come to the dirty section, what was the role of the battalion? Were you on, was it on guard duties or what was it doing?
Yes, guard duties. Guard duties of all sorts. For places which were apt to be attacked, like the general post office, the, what did they call it, where the commanding officer, who was French, had gone, and MacCready, who'd been commanding the Metropolitan Police, he was a very good CO at, we didn't call it Government House, but that's where we used to do guard.
Vice Regal Lodge, was it?
Vice Regal Lodge. And you went out on patrol at night when the Irish were supposed to be shut in, but you found the local harlots all dreadfully low grade. I'm sorry for them. We had to pick them up, and in the end we said, well, that's no good doing that. So we let them just do what they liked in the end.
So you were on patrols enforcing the curfew?
That's right. That was the curfew patrol. Oh, that was everything. Then, of course, there was the famous Lucan Guard, which I dealt with. That was 5 miles outside. The only place that hadn't been burnt down were the police. And you went out with your... you went out with your platoon as a subaltern and took over guard of the place behind barbed wire, where there were about 30 to 40 policemen who couldn't go anywhere unless you took them out in the armoured cars.